This episode is brought to you by Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma. When it's time for an aircraft component inspection, overhaul, repair, or replacement, you need experienced technicians you can trust and friendly service you can count on. Aircraft Accessories of Oklahoma, a family-owned business since 1959, delivers just that.
Our techs have real-world experience and provide sales, service, and overhaul for piston engine aircraft accessories. We also have limited turbine capabilities such as fuel pumps, starter generators, and prop governors. And we can overhaul propellers ranging from fixed pitch to turbine. Propeller pickup and delivery service is available. And one more thing, mention this podcast to receive 5% off your next sale, service, or overhaul. Visit aircraftaccessoriesofok.com.
Hi, I'm Mike Bush.
I'm Paul New.
And I'm Colleen Sterling. Welcome to Ask the AMPs from AOPA.
On Ask the AMPs, we take your toughest maintenance questions and we try to solve them. We don't always solve them, but we try to solve them. So if you have a question, please reach out to us at podcasts@aopa.org.
If you like the show, make sure to follow and subscribe so you never miss an episode.
And if you'd like to get on our email list for our monthly newsletter and occasional interesting maintenance stories, the easiest way to do that is to text the word SAVVY, S-A-V-V-Y, to 33777, and a little email bot will put you on our mailing list. Again, text SAVVY, S-A-V-V-Y, to 33777 to put yourself on the list.
Here we are again.
Groundhog Day. Right? Oh, no, that was last week. That was last week. We just watched that movie. So I wanted to talk about, I have an airplane in the engine, in the avionics shop, having a new engine monitor put in because my old engine monitor didn't cut the mustard. It only recorded 2 hours of data at a time. And you had to do a handstand on one hand to get the data out of the monitor. So it was definitely past its prime.
Wow. You're not going to mention what kind of monitor that was.
It was an old monitor. It was from 2001.
They're not even in production anymore, are they?
It was not a JPI. This is an experimental.
Oh. Is it MGM?
No.
No, not that one.
MG. No. I don't want to make anybody feel bad. They've since upgraded the engine monitor, but when the airplane builder was building the airplane, he bought an engine monitor and then by the time he got the engine, the airplane done, it was already 5 years down the road. And then by the time I got the airplane, it was 20 years down the road. So this thing was a little long in the tooth. So I'm going with a Garmin and I'm very excited about that. I feel like I'm improving the airplane, but I have to say, I go almost every other day to check on the progress and see how they're doing and what's going on. And the airplane looks like it's having brain surgery. I mean, the whole panel on that side is out and all the circuit breakers are lying there and there's wires everywhere. And all I can think is, how the heck do these guys know what these wires were connected to? I mean,
They really don't.
Anytime I've ever taken my airplane to an avionics shop, I always have this feeling it's never going to fly again. When you see it in that condition, with all its guts hanging out, it's like, there's no way they're ever going to be able to put this thing back together.
And this wasn't a certified airplane with beautiful wiring diagrams. There were scribbled wiring diagrams and pinouts and things like that. But they're finding things like, why did he do it this way? Or what is this wire? How do they do this? And I teach electrical and avionics in AMP school, but we just do the 4313 by the book stuff, this wire connects to this wire with this kind of terminal and, three grounds to any grounding point. And no offense to the builder, because he was very meticulous, but I think the airplane was over-engineered. There was a lot of wiring and a lot of nice little options and lights and switches and stuff that I'm just afraid that I'm going to try to go flying and I'm not going to have any, gear down and lock lights because that was in this plug and they eliminated this plug. And it's
prepare
a frightening
yourself.
Prospect.
Well, I'm guessing that they tag a lot of wires when they take it apart.
Yeah, there's all kinds of labels on all these
and
wires.
And I'm also guessing that every so often they get into one of these, I don't know where this wire goes, but let's get out the ohmmeter and see if we can figure it out mode.
Basic skills, yeah. But that adds to the labor, right? So, I'm just glad they're doing it and not me. I mean, I'm embarrassed to say I'm taking my airplane
to a shop. You're glad they're
doing
it, but not you until you get the invoice.
Yeah. But it makes me appreciate how much of my time it would have been, and I could never do it as professionally as they're doing it. They're doing a beautiful job.
No, you'd be paralyzed by fear.
I would be paralyzed by fear. You know me too well.
I just put a test fluid yesterday, a digital autopilot in my Cirrus, and I put in the Garmin, and it's I had a little trouble. I was working with the avionics shop doing this, and there's a lot of frustration because I'm an old avionics guy. I mean, when I left avionics, GPS was a rumor, and we were installing IFR low-rand. So those of you that know this stuff know how old that is. And I was having a real problem in that the servos are all on a CAN bus. Each servo has power and ground and a CAN bus, which is basically twisted pair wires. And that's it. And I'm from the world of, you have 80 pounds of wiring for an autopilot. And when I used to work for a little commuter airline, we had Hadley Page jet streams, not BAE jet streams, but Hadley Page jet streams. And I put in dual audio panels in these two airplanes. They had a single keying audio panel. This is back in the mid early 80s. So all this work was done at night, and I was much younger then. And the director of maintenance and the president of the company came into the hangar one night. It's about 1 o'clock in the morning, so I can only imagine where they had been. And here's this 20-year-old kid, and I've got these massive wiring harnesses hanging over my shoulders that I had pre-built, and I had carried them into the airplane. The airplane's gutted. The instrument panels are all gone, and I'm sitting on a milk crate in between what was the pilot and co-pilot seat, and I'm sort of straddling the center console, and I'm getting ready to lay these harnesses in the airplane. And these two guys came in, they looked at me, and I'm 20 or 21, and I'm the only guy doing this. I've got a week to get it done. This is day two, I think. And I looked around, and I don't know that I've ever seen the look of panic on two adult men like I saw them. But that's what I'm used to, lots of wires. And this digital autopilot basically had two. And I had to call and say, are you sure? Aren't there some more wires that go here? And no, that's it.
Our first question is from Jim, who wants to know how much carbon is too much. Go ahead, Jim.
Okay, let me first say that I'm just very honored to be in such esteemed company. I mean, you folks, I've been listening to all your podcasts, and it's been amazing. I've been in aircraft maintenance engaged for 49 years, and I'm still picking up hints and tips from you guys that help me operate my own airplane. So,
cool.
Good.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I have a Cessna 182 0470R, you know, good engine, bad induction system, the whole nine yards. And I got an overhaul about 1,100 hours ago, brand new Millennium cylinders. And since then, I've changed two cylinders for exhaust valves, and that's another whole story. I'm not going to do that again after, you know, looking at all the data and seeing all the podcasts, and obviously lapping valves is the way to go. But in any event, you know, the oil consumption has climbed steadily over the years, and now I'm doing about 5 hours to one quart. But I am noticing in the filter, there's a lot of carbon, and probably the two cylinder changes were over the last 3 years. Prior to that, the carbon kept building to the point where I had probably a good full teaspoon of carbon I could get out of the filter. And I noticed with the cylinder changes, there's less carbon, but there's still a fair amount. And my real question is, can this be harming anything, the carbon itself? I mean, I suspect it's coming from from the oil control rings, you know, letting the oil get carboned up. But I'm just more concerned, not so much about the oil consumption, but about the carbon itself in the filter.
Well, the carbon itself isn't going to do any damage, but it's indicative of a problem that I think it'd be worth expending some effort to run down. The carbon in the oil, I mean, it means basically that oil is getting cooked probably by excessive blow-by in one or more cylinders. And it's not the oil control rings that are responsible for that, it's the compression rings. If a lot of combustion gases are getting by the compression rings in one of the cylinders, then that's going to cook a bunch of oil and carbonize it and wind up in the oil filter.
And the other clue that you had blow-by was you said the oil gets black after oil changes. You said the oil gets black very quickly. That means the blow-by products are getting past all the rings and getting into the crankcase, or the oil is mixing with the combustion gases and getting dirty too quickly. You also said it comes out the crankcase vent. That was another indication that you're pressurizing
the crankcase, right. So all of these symptoms are pointing at the same thing. And the guess is that the culprit is one of the cylinders that aren't the ones you replaced recently.
That would be the
I mean, what you really need to do is compression check and borescope inspection and see if you can figure out which cylinder is the culprit.
Yeah, I've been doing that probably about every 6 months. I mean, when I change the oil at 6 months, I pretty much do a mini annual on the engine and look in the cylinders, the borescope check, and compression checks. And compressions are good in the 70s, low 70s.
Wow.
And the borescope looks good. Now, a few cylinders, I've noticed some vertical lines, but nothing exaggerated or...
Yeah, some vertical scoring is pretty normal. Are you noticing any oil puddling in any of the cylinders?
Not really. The plugs are all dry. I clean the plugs every 6 months, and they seem pretty dry. And I'm looking at the heads of the pistons, I don't notice any oil.
It would be down at the bottom, like, or in the spark plugs, like you said.
I wish my engine was doing just a quart in 5 hours instead of a quart in less than 5 hours.
Paul isn't going to say. He doesn't want to embarrass himself.
But going back to the question about the carbon, Jim, Mike's saying that it's not really harmful. Mike, could it possibly get into like the Vernotherm or the... anything that would, you know, prevent things from closing properly, maintaining
carbon
oil pressure?
Carbon is typically very tiny particles and very soft particles. So, I don't think of the carbon as causing any risk, but I do think of it as being symptomatic that there's excessive blow-by, and then all these other things all seem to confirm that there's excessive blow-by. And it's probably not like all the cylinders that are doing that, it's probably just one or maybe two cylinders that are doing that.
Yeah.
Well, when the carbon breaks loose, the first place it goes is to the oil sump. The second place it goes is to the filter.
So the filter's doing its job.
I don't have much, I wouldn't have much concern about that.
Well, unless there was so much carbon that it would plug the filter and put it into bypass, but...
Teaspoon isn't going to do that.
A teaspoon. And I don't know of any guidance
teaspoon's
from Continental
a lot,
on what, how much is too much or how
there's
much
no
is...
There's no guidance from Continental.
I've never seen anything.
I begged Continental to come out with a service bulletin like Homings.
You dared them to.
And they won't do it.
You double-dog dared them.
Other than tearing into the engine, can I operate this way until some other parameter gets concerning or...
I think you can.
Oil's cheap. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You keep monitoring the filter, as Mike was saying, if it gets totally coated, it could be an issue.
The one thing I'm thinking is that you might want to shorten your oil and filter change interval, because that is a bit of a scary amount. Again, my concern is that we don't want the filter to get plugged up. Because if the filter gets too plugged up, then the bypass valve will open and you'll wind up passing unfiltered oil into the oil galleries.
Yeah, okay. And that's good, because my big concern, like you said, was like Colleen mentioned, maybe something getting clogged. Not so much the Vernatherm, but I'm thinking of an oil jet inside somewhere.
Yeah.
And I just want to get a feeling for that.
Well, cylinders are disposable items on an airplane, right? They're wear items. They're bolt on.
Yeah, but you've got to figure out which one's the culprit. You don't want to start pulling cylinders at random.
Yeah. So he's bore scoping, like you should.
So I think you live with the problem, you reduce your oil change interval, and then eventually the culprit cylinder will rear its ugly head because it'll get really, really bad.
And you'll start seeing oil in the plugs.
Yeah.
Okay. That sounds like real good advice. Definitely puts my mind at ease a little bit.
It's a lot cheaper than changing the cylinders out.
Yeah. We don't like to see cylinders removed before their time.
No, and after reading some of this stuff, I get paranoid about the bearing press and all that stuff. I don't want to touch them, you know, as far as removing them goes.
Yep. It's like living with that bad appendix until it really gets bad. And then go for the surgery.
Oh, man.
Sorry.
Mine went bad when I was in third grade.
Oh, really?
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I still have mine.
Yeah. That I know of.
I haven't had mine since third grade.
Well.
Well, that was a diversion there. Squirrel.
Yeah. Great, great question, Jim. Thanks for calling the doctors here. The clinic.
And I'll keep an eye on my appendix, too.
Yeah. Keep checking that appendix.
Okay.
Every 35 hours.
Thank you for calling.
See you, Jim.
Bye-bye. See you. Thanks.
Our next question is from John, who's wondering if there's any truth in advertising. Go ahead, John.
It's a good intro. Look, I'll give you a bit of background. I have a 1995 J model Mooney, and I've flown it for about 2,000 hours. 5 years ago, I had an IO360A3B6 engine fitted in place of the original engine with the dual mag. And when the first magneto inspection was due, I had one mag replaced with a Surefly electronic ignition. Overall, I'm very happy with the Surefly, but I do wonder whether the aircraft is just a little slower. A couple of times a year, I check the actual TAS by noting the ground speed by flying cardinal directions at 65% power at 7,000 feet. And obviously the average TAS that I get depends on rigging and how recently I've polished the airplane. But before the Surefly, it averaged 153, 155 knots, which is pretty well book numbers. But now it's down about 149, 150. And my question is whether the variable ignition timing of the Surefly would reduce the actual power output of the engine. Specifically, if I set 23-inch 2400 RPM, which would normally be 65% power on that engine, am I still actually getting 65% power?
Okay, there are two things that come to mind here. You know, one thing is the variable timing feature of the Surefly, which I don't think would be an issue here because I don't think it kicks in until the manifold pressure is well below 23 inches. If you wondered about that, it would be very easy to turn off the variable timing, which is just a dip switch setting on the Surefly, and see if it makes any difference. But I don't think it would because I don't think the vacuum advance, if you want to call it that, kicks in at a manifold pressure as high as 23 inches. What I think is more likely is that the Surefly was not properly timed to the engine. This is something we see a lot with the Surefly because the timing procedure is totally different than it is for a normal magneto. The Surefly wants to be timed at 0 degrees, physically timed at 0 degrees before top dead center, right where the piston is, right at top dead center. And then the advance is set with the dip switches, not with physical rotation of the Surefly. And unless mechanics are really familiar with the Surefly, they often mess that up. So that would be my first suspicion is that the thing is not timed properly. And it needs to be, you need to read the instructions very carefully and make sure that they're followed, because they're completely different than timing a normal magneto.
If you have an engine monitor, one way to kind of check would be to look at your EGTs during these tests before your SureFly install, and then look at them afterwards and see if they're higher. Because to follow on what Mike is talking about, the assumption would be that the SureFly would be firing later, so that it's not actually happening, is not contributing to the combustion as it should. So you're basically flying around on one magneto, and that would mean that would cause your EGTs to go up.
And your CHTs to go down.
And just CHTs like mag, go down. So
like
you're
a mag check.
Yeah, but, yeah, it's like doing an in-flight mag check.
I don't know when this installation happened, but you may or may not still have data from before the thing went
in. Yeah, I definitely do have that data, but it is very interesting that you mentioned that, because I have noticed CHTs seem to be lower.
Oh.
So that confirms my suspicion that the thing was not properly timed, and we see that a lot with the SureFly, like I said, because the timing procedure is so radically different than what mechanics are accustomed to doing and have been trained to do. So I would revisit the timing and make sure that the timing is done in exact accordance with the instructions in the SureFly manual. It is very different. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just different.
Yeah, just different.
And it's not what mechanics are accustomed to.
And John, are you on Mooney Space at all? That's the online forum for Mooney.
Yeah,
owners.
I do look at it occasionally, not frequently.
Me too, but I looked at it today. I actually did a search asking about this, and there's a long discussion about performance with a SureFly on this engine. And people reported that they maybe got a few more knots when they were lean of peak at higher altitudes, but basically their speeds are the same. And they also confirmed that the SureFly doesn't even kick in with the advanced timing until you get above, say, 8,000 feet. So if you're reporting...
Well, it doesn't really go with altitude.
It goes with manifold pressure. But they said that the manifold pressure you'd get at 8,000 feet is about where you'd see it to start to kick in.
You should get a few more knots out of the SureFly up at altitude where the variable timing does kick in, but you shouldn't really see any difference in airspeed with the manifold pressure above where it kicks in.
Right, because it's not doing anything.
It does have a little hotter spark and stuff, but it probably wouldn't, that alone would not make a noticeable change in performance. It would make a noticeable change in how well the engine, how quickly the engine starts and stuff.
Everybody
like that.
Said it starts great, just like a car is what they said. So.
But it's at lower manifold pressures, which would typically be at higher altitudes. But the key thing is it's at lower manifold pressures that you should see the speed advantage. But if you're seeing a speed disadvantage, then it seems very likely that the electronic mag is not timed correctly. The SureFly is not timed correctly, and it is a pretty bizarre. No, that's nothing bizarre about it. It's just so different.
Yeah, you hook a little voltage onto a particular pin, and the light comes on. You rotate number one cylinder to top dead center until the light goes out. It has a half a degree window where the light is extinguished. And this little LED is actually on the magneto itself. And so when you get it where the light is extinguished, that's it. But the whole process is on the SureFly
So no more flower pot on the spinner?
Well, not on the Lycoming. On a Continental, you still have to find top dead center.
Oh, okay.
And for a SureFly, you have to time it on cylinder number one. When I time magnetos on a Continental, I usually time on cylinder number five because it's close to the prop. You can time on any cylinder you want, but on the SureFly, you have to do it on cylinder number one. And on the Lycoming, you know, you've got that wonderful big flywheel that's marked and no special tools required.
With nail polish.
With nail polish. Oh, nail polish. Oh.
Works great.
I didn't know about the nail polish.
I knew pink was going to come into this.
Yeah, it's a little tip.
Hidden in here somewhere.
Yeah, it can't be green nail polish. It's got to be.
I don't own green nail polish.
But yeah, I would definitely revisit the timing on the Sure-Fly.
Especially, you know, if your CHTs are a little bit lower and EGTs are higher than they were before, that's
sounds
a nice
like a winner.
Confirmation. Yeah. That's a good place to start. It's an excellent question, John.
Yeah, it is a great question.
I have the annual coming up pretty soon, so we'll double and triple check all of that, and I'll let you know what results.
Awesome. Yeah, we'd like feedback.
Yeah, thanks for the call.
Hey, David, I got a riddle for you. How can you upgrade your next flight without upgrading your airplane?
I think upgrading the pilot would be the first clue for that one.
The guy between the headsets, huh? Yeah.
That's right.
All right. That's not what I'm talking about, but I'll give you a clue. It has ADS-B traffic and weather, Sirius XM weather and entertainment, no wires, and it works with 4Flight and Garmin Pilot.
Oh, Ian, I know what that is. It's the Garmin GDL52 Sirius XM portable weather receiver.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. And now, believe it or not, the Garmin GDL52 comes with a 3-month trial of Sirius XM aviation weather and a very special limited time $400 rebate. Learn more about all that this receiver can do and the limited time $400 rebate by visiting sporties.com/GDL52.
Our next question is from Jim, who's doing some belt tightening, maybe post-Christmas belt tightening. What's up, Jim?
Well, first of all, it's my first time live, and it's really a terrific opportunity to talk to you people directly. Mine is an issue that's caused me a lot of frustration. The alternator drive belt keeps popping off. Let me give you a little bit of background. The belt has about 140 hours on it, and we believe it to be the correct belt. I've put a straight edge on the two pulleys, the drive pulley, the engine drive pulley, and also the alternator pulley. I put a straight edge, and it looks like they're in alignment. The alternator was overhauled, and bearings and brushes were changed. So it'll fly for maybe, this is a Cessna 182, by the way, it'll fly for about maybe 10 or so hours, and it flips off. And I am checking the tension on the belt, the tension and the, I push down on the belt in the middle about a half inch. I do all of those things, but I don't think I've solved the problem. I don't think I've found the root cause.
Well, you got several options here, and it's really common on the 0470. I don't know why it always decides to happen right after you put a different alternator on, but it seems that it does like to do that. There's the possibility of counterweight issues, but that doesn't make sense that would happen because you've changed an alternator, except that you have a different balance on the newly installed alternator. But you can get vibrations and oscillations from the pulley. You can also have grooves in the pulley that will make the alternator belt roll. And then when it rolls and twists, then it breaks and falls off. The engine-driven pulley, or the drive pulley, as we call it, is on a shaft, and that shaft moves forward and aft. And sometimes when that shaft is worn, it will move fore and aft way more than you want it to, or the shaft bearing is worn somewhat, and it will be moving up and down or in and out. As you tighten the belt, the shaft is no longer parallel to the alternator's shaft. So that puts the pulley, it doesn't look like it's out of alignment, but it may be just a little bit. Those are just a couple of quick items that you can check, but the pulley would be probably the low-hanging fruit to be looking for, see if you can get an improvement on it.
So
the drive pulley is mounted on the starter adapter, right? It's a shaft that comes out of the back of the starter adapter.
Yeah,
that's on the back of the engine. Yeah, left rear.
So it has to be replaced in whole with the starter adapter.
The pulley is mounted on an extension of the starter adapter shaft gear, if I recall correctly. So can the free play on that be checked?
Yeah, I mean, it's a simple...
There's something worn in the starter
adapter. Yeah, with the belt off, you just grab hold of the pulley and push it forward and aft and see how far it moves. And depending on which version adapter, you can contact Niagara Air Parts or one of the other shops that do starter adapter work. Or you can look in the Continental Manual and it will tell you what the allowance is.
But the other thing that Paul mentioned, which is definitely a concern on these engines, is the possibility, and it's relatively remote, but it's a possibility that you might have a detuned crankshaft counterweight and there's, you know, torsional things going on with the back of the crankshaft. And I think probably the best way to rule that out would be to get somebody with a dynamic prop balance rig to do vibration check on the engine when it's run up to, you know, something like cruise power, and see if there's an inordinate vibration.
You know, I used to think that was the silliest answer. Of course, I know now that that's a really a good answer, because in my mind, I thought, okay, this is a big hunk of aluminum crankcase and all that, and surely this thing isn't moving that much. And I was talking to our friend Bill Ross many, many years ago, and he was describing an event where Continental ran one of their engines under a strobe light and just took a video of it. And he said it looked like it was liquid because it
flapping
moved.
Around.
It was just moving around. He said, if you ever saw that video, you'd never fly behind one of these engines again. You just never get in it.
So, I read that, yeah.
That's
so
just
I've seen videos that stop motion videos of propellers, aluminum propellers, where the blades are, you know, have all these standing waves in them and stuff. It's just, it's amazing to watch.
So I was really surprised in just searching online that this is a really common problem with a 182. And there's a lot of discussion. I think I saw it on Cessna Flyers or something like that. Cessna Flyer Association. And there were suggestions about checking the bearings, checking the play and the pulley. I think what we're saying is do the external things first. You don't want to like split your case because you think maybe your dynamic, you know, there's any kind of vibrations inside the engine. Do the stuff you can do outside the engine first, which would be to check the pulley for play in the bearings or in the pulley shafts.
You know, the thing to think about is you changed an alternator and that caused all this to begin. So the counterbalances on the crankshaft, nothing really would have changed with those, more than likely. Although, as I said, the balance of the different alternator may be responding to the existing balance of the engine. So there is a change in play between the two. But just like Colleen said, it's definitely check the easy things first. And they're easy to check, and they're way less expensive. You can get to the counterbalances by removing the two back
cylinders. Yeah.
So you don't have to necessarily, you know, split the case halves. But way before you get to that point, let's check these other things.
There is no play side to side on that drive pulley, but there is a little bit of front and back play, maybe as much as a 32nd of an inch. And I think that a lot of that is probably taken up as the case expands in heat. I think there's intended to be some play. It's not zero.
Play. Yeah, there has to be some play. But you want to make sure that it's within the limits. Limits on that.
That should be easy enough to check with the play to the engine case with the thickness gauge.
Sure. Yep.
The belt is the correct belt, and it doesn't show any fraying on the side of the belt like there's something out of line. You know, usually when you look at the belt and there's white, you know, thread showing on the edge of the belt, nothing. And there's 140 hours on the belt.
So what brand of belt are you using? Is it let me ask this. It's a V belt. Is it a continuous belt or is it a segmented belt?
It's a segmented belt with the segments on the inside.
Right.
And the belt is some product supplied by Continental. I don't know the manufacturer of the belt.
I would try a solid belt and see what difference that makes.
Okay.
I also saw somebody suggested you check for wear in the pulley's V groove.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was talking about with checking the pulleys. Yep.
This would be the drive pulley.
I think so.
Because the alternator pulley's new.
The alternator pulley's new.
And the commenter said you can actually take the old pulley to a machine shop and have them reface it to restore the groove face and angle.
I've never had that done.
I know. It's very interesting. This was all on the Cessna Flyers.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great question, Jim.
Yeah. That was a new one for me. So very interesting.
Well, you're a Cardinal owner, you know.
Never heard of the belt slipping off. That's crazy. Flapping off.
This is a Sandcast Continental
issue. Yep. Yeah. All right. Thank you, Jim.
Good luck, Jim. Our next question is from David, who is doing some late Christmas shopping. Go ahead, David.
That's right. I recently purchased a Piper Lance Turbo, and I've heard Mike say on the show a couple times he carries a few critical spare parts with him in his 310 and has been known to make repairs on the ramp. I've read his article on the emergency toolbox, I believe. Mm-hmm. So my question is, what spare parts would you A&Ps recommend owners have on hand? And more importantly, which of those spare parts would be recommended to keep on board during cross-country flights? Now, since sending in the question, I've had a couple of AOG experiences that have started my go bag of parts. So, for example, I now carry a main tire and tube. I carry a spare fuel boost pump. I've got a Piper plug and a jump pack with me, a quart of oil, and a basic set of tools. But what else?
That must have an interesting effect on weight and balance.
Yeah. I have two criteria for this, and everybody has a different opinion. And one criteria is you only take along with you things that you're willing to change. And the second one is take along with you things that most shops aren't going to have in stock. Like back in the early Cirrus and Columbia days, nobody kept low-profile tires in stock, so you definitely wanted to take a tire along. Well, nowadays, Behringer wheels, you want to take a tubeless tire along with you and maybe the special tool for jacking the airplane, that sort of thing. So that's kind of where I start.
Yeah, my experience with this is that it's very, very airplane type specific. You know, my first airplane was a Cessna 182, very beloved Cessna 182 that I bought brand new from the Cessna factory in 1968. And it was a wonderful airplane, but it used to go through voltage regulators on a regular basis. Now, this was back in the days when the voltage regulators had vibrating contacts. Yeah, they weren't
Delco Remy. You could borrow some off a Chevy.
After the second time that I got stranded and spent a night on a hard bench in an FBO because the voltage regulator had crapped out and I was waiting for one to be FedExed into me, I decided I was going to carry a second voltage regulator, a spare voltage regulator, so that I would be prepared for these failures. Of course, you know the rest of the story. The minute I started carrying a spare, I never had another voltage regulator failure. Yep. Because that's the way it kind of works.
That's what you do, yeah.
The spare parts radiate a force field somehow. But, you know, now I'm flying.
That's the logic I'm using behind loading the plane up with all these spare parts.
So now I'm flying a Cessna 310. The voltage regulators never fail. They're solid state. But the 310 has a habit of going through vacuum pumps. And the vacuum pumps are the big 400 series vacuum pumps that because the airplane has de-icing boots. And they're expensive and nobody keeps them in stock. So I always carry a spare pump with me and the special trick wrench that you need to get that one nut that you can't get to with a regular wrench.
A chisel and a hammer will do.
And that's that's an important point with in terms of carrying tools. The most important tools to carry are the ones that you're not likely to be able to get at your local Ace Hardware store. If you need a number two Phillips screwdriver, you can almost always find one somewhere. But if you need safety wire pliers, that's going to be harder. So the most important tools to carry with you are specialty tools that would be hard to procure locally if you had a problem. And the most important spare parts to carry with you are ones that have let you down in the past.
And don't forget the duct tape.
Duct tape and tie wraps, for sure. So
duct tape and tie wraps, and duct tape comes in airplane colors.
Maybe a little JB Weld, you know, while you're at
JB
it.
JB Weld. But,
you know.
Colleen, what do you carry in your plane?
You know, I went to Alaska and I dragged a vacuum pump the whole way up and back and it never failed. It was high time and I thought that was going to be cheap insurance.
Right.
But I did use the duct tape because I put a hole in one of the plastic tips on my tail. Oh. And duct tape came in very handy. And
was it the
white.
Right color?
It was white. It looked great.
Perfect. Yeah.
So, but I'm guilty. I carry a first aid kit, but I really don't carry anything other than a stubby screwdriver so I can take my cowl off.
You do know that it is now possible to buy clear duct tape, don't you? Which is...
No, I didn't. Really?
If you have to duct tape something that you wouldn't want an FAA inspector to notice that you duct tape, clear duct tape is the way to go.
I don't know. They're pretty
sure. But if that's a hole, maybe you want the white.
Yeah, the white works great.
But, well, yeah. Thank you guys very much. I really appreciate the time you take to share your knowledge with all of us in GA. And really, this is amazing, valuable information to all of us.
Great. And thank you. And as you referenced, Mike wrote a great article about this. It's called Traveling Toolkit. And it's in his book, Airplane Ownership Volume 1, but it's also an article that he wrote in AOPA Pilot in July 2017.
Yeah, Google
and
it.
We've got a copy reproduced on the Savvy Aviation website under resources. So if people want to read more about Mike's suggestions, they can go there. Thank you for the question.
I just fly around and hope nothing breaks. So,
all right. Thanks a lot, David.
Thanks, David.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, so we got a great letter that I want to read to everybody. This is from a fan. It says, I don't have a question, but I want to say a big thank you. I have a Beechcraft A36. It's a great airplane with a great engine that has over 1,100 hours. Everything has been running great. Sounds like everything's great so far. And I only consume about a quart of oil every 25 to 30 hours.
Oh, wow. Jealous.
That hurts.
I know. I've owned this airplane for just over 5 years and never had any engine problems. It has lots of power and it does everything I ask. I have a JPI 930 installed and I run at Lena Peak while in cruise and I'm very judicious about that. I took my airplane into its usual shop for its annual inspection last week. I've been a bit suspicious that this shop was in the business of finding problems that might not exist. But they generally did really good work over the past several years and it was a case of using the Reagan term trust but verify. This year they went overboard. I got a call and the mechanic told me that all six of the cylinders had flunked the compression check in the mid-30s with one at 15 and that the valves were exhibiting signs of quote stress. I was not sure what stress meant. Either they were burned or they weren't. Stress is a meaningless term. Replacing six cylinders all at once had me asking lots of questions, which is good.
I like this guy.
Yeah, this is good. Yeah. I called one of the mechanics at the American Bonanza Society and asked him some questions. Then I had a friend send me your recent podcast, quote, compression readings are garbage, which is, I love that one. And that made me very skeptical of the major surgery that my mechanic wanted to do. Yesterday, I took my airplane to a new shop on the field and it was time for a second opinion. They did the same run-up compression check and borescope inspection. And they called me and said, Jim, you do not need any new cylinders. You have two valves that need to be replaced. That's it. Mm-hmm. So I'm moving forward with those repairs and saving thousands of dollars in the process. Thousands.
Well, saying he's got two bad valves but doesn't have to have any cylinders replaced sounds like that shop wants to lap them, which is really
which is
good.
Great.
Maybe we're getting our message at.
Yeah.
Oh, you know how you can tell mechanics that are in the business of finding problems where none exist? They have IA after their signature.
Oh. I thought you were going to say they get kickbacks.
That's right. So you guys are, I mean, this is like meaningful change here. I mean, this
like it really is. That's awesome. Very heartwarming to hear
he was
an
doing
activist owner
right.
like that. Yeah.
And he was listening to his intuition. The airplane had been running fine for years. Why would all six go wrong
Yeah.
It just didn't make any sense.
I bet that first shop did an ice cold compression test, probably.
Or they did the compression chest test with the spark plugs out or something goofy like that.
Look at these numbers. You're not supposed to take both spark plugs out when you do a compression
test? Even
I
would catch that one. I mean, come on. Oh, that is great. And I don't know the two shops, but the second one was paying attention. That's really great.
Well, you know, he was really lucky that he had two shops on the field.
That's true.
Because there'd be a lot of airports. Yeah. There's one shop on the field.
And you're stuck.
You're stuck.
Hmm. That's true. You could tow it, right? So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, Jim. Appreciate it for writing in.
Great.
That's
letter.
Awesome. Our next question is from Dustin, who's concerned whether all mechanics might be crooked. Good to see you, Dustin.
Thanks for having me.
This is dangerous territory you're treading on here.
Well, you know, luckily it's virtual, so I don't have to worry about any physical attacks. Okay. But proud AOPA member, appreciate what you guys are doing. This, you know, fortunately I can say, although maybe it happened to me and it was unknown, friend in a pilot's forum posed a question, really kind of asking how people feel or if they know what's happened. Had an engine his shop was recommending for overhaul, some email communications between him and the director of maintenance, as well as the engine shops directly. So all three of them tied into an email chain, kind of discussing options and looking at some quotes. One of those shops emailed back the director of maintenance with excluding the pilot owner and offered a $2,000 referral fee for his work. And the director of maintenance, to his credit, was open enough with the pilot to tell him directly, hey, this is what they've offered me, and I'm willing to pass it on to you if that's what you decide. The big questions that came up, you know, first of all, is this a common practice? Secondly, really, was how people felt about this. I mean, most of us, maybe we're naive, but we feel like when we go to the shop, we like to be able to trust the DOM or trust the A&P as to what their recommendations are and that they're looking out for our best interests. Yes, it's a business. They got to make money. They got to do well. We understand that. Just like we expect things to be bought at wholesale and, you know, and a markup to retail prices. Mm-hmm. But something like this seemed kind of disturbing to at least some of us in the chats and the forums to say, hey, this, you know, this seems a little more like a bribe or coercion. And especially if the DOM wasn't upfront to tell the pilot owner, it seems like they could be much more likely to maybe steer you towards a shop that might not be the best for what you're looking for.
We don't experience that. I have four or five engine shops that I deal with, and I don't, maybe they bribe other shops and not me. Maybe I'm losing out. I don't know. There is a very large engine shop that gives a kickback is not the right word. If a rebate, incentive, you know, if, depending on what term you use, it sounds better, right? Kickback sounds underhanded, whereas rebate sounds fair. And I never quite figured out why this one shop, they'll give the buyer of the engine, meaning the shop, $1,000 bonus, kickback, whatever. And I'm thinking, why don't you just have a markup and give it, state a wholesale price and a retail price? Because as you say, everyone kind of accepts that. And
well,
at
that's
the end
effectively
of the day,
what they're doing.
It exactly, except
but they don't call it that.
They don't call
well,
it that.
Well, it doesn't matter what they call it. I mean, look, it's if you buy a part through your shop, you expect them to purchase it at wholesale and sell it to you at retail. That's just the way the world works.
Oh, it is. That's not what I'm saying.
If you don't want to do that, then you need to purchase it yourself. I mean, for parts that don't have astronomically high prices, that's just kind of something that we accept. And for things like engines that do have astronomically high prices, you know, I always recommend that the owner purchase the engine directly and have it drop shipped to the shop, which not only eliminates any sort of wholesale retail business, but it also often allows you to not pay sales tax, which is a big chunk of money on an engine.
Sure. Yeah, and I'm not disagreeing. I'm just explaining this is how the system usually works. Usually it's, we have a wholesale price. That's what we pay. And then we turn around and we add something to it. So we kind of have a little, if you want to know how prices work at my shop, if you buy a $50,000 engine in percentages, the markup is going to be very small. We don't make 10%. We don't even make 5% on an engine. If you buy a 56-cent O-ring, by golly, there may be a 200% markup on that. Just to take care of the time it takes Helen to write invoices. If we have a local guy come in and wants to buy a bolt or an O-ring or something, we beg them, please don't make us write up an invoice because it's going to cost us several dollars to create this invoice for this 56-cent part.
So you give them away.
Yeah, sure. Or we tell them, replace it. Because the reason they don't want to buy one from Aircraft Spruce or whatever is they don't want to pay all those costs. We're like, well, that's fine, but we did. So don't buy it, but replace it someday.
Actually, the Paul says, you know, I'll give you the bolt if you buy me lunch. I think that's
probably that'll work too. Yeah. I'm okay with that.
Paul, do you charge shipping separately for?
Yes,
you do. So yeah. It's not like that resale wholesale thing is. It includes shipping. It's basically covering your time to do the invoicing and receive parts and put them in the bins and
right.
So, research what you're shopping for.
Yeah. And this is, I know this isn't quite the question that Dustin asked, but just kind of, and every shop does it a little bit differently. We pay a lot of money to have the manuals, to have the space to store parts. The time it takes to look up all the part numbers that we're going to purchase is not something that we do on the clock. So when we sell a part, the markup on the part is what pays for all of that overhead.
Dustin was talking about a $2,000, whatever he called it, fee on a $40,000 engine. That's 5%, which is not unreasonable for.
No, that's not terrible, unless there was already a markup.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
He got this kickback. Really, that great that the sound, shop would let him
that
know.
That doesn't
up front.
Sound likely.
Yeah. Well, so that's where some of the concern, I think, comes in. One is intent. I mean, we're all human beings. And so unlike our engines, we're not operating and making decisions, you know, just based on pure science. Mm-hmm. And so I think people can be influenced and can be biased. And that's a concern. I think the thing about the expectation about a markup is you're expecting that's going to come from anybody. So, and part of the issue in this point is that buying direct from the engine shop certainly is a good option and a consideration for a pilot owner, but when they're not sure who to get the work done from, and they're looking to the A&P for advice,
sure,
that's where the speculation comes in, I think.
But that's how the A&P is earning his $2,000.
Right, but what I would rather see then, if that's the case, is why are you allowing one shop to offer perhaps a bribe and not the others? I would rather than see an honest discussion between. Well,
let's not call it a bribe. Let's call it a discount, okay? Because that's what it is, and it's very unlikely that only one shop is offering an FBO discount. It's more likely that all shops are doing it. It may be that only this one was visible to you, but this is standard practice in the industry.
Really? You think so, Mike?
If you order an engine through your mechanic, he will always make a profit on it.
He should.
And if you don't want him to make a profit on it, then you have to do it yourself.
The difference is the mechanic determining what that profit's going to be and adding it to the price.
Well, but that's up to the mechanic or the shop. So maybe look at it a little differently. If you need an engine, if you need a new engine, which horrible event that you would actually need a new engine. You can only get a brand new engine from Wilson. This is a Continental. You can only buy it from Continental through Air Power, and they don't make a whole lot on each one because they sell a bazillion of them every year, and that's where everybody buys them. If I buy an engine from Air Power, I pay the same price as if you buy an engine from Air Power. The difference comes in is when you need engine work, like an overhaul. You do an overhaul by John Jewell or Ram or any of the other shops out there and how they respond. So I would suggest if you're going to go that route and have your engine overhauled, go onto the forums and say, where have you guys all done it? Don't just rely on your mechanic, because your mechanic, like me, I have three or four engine shops that I deal with. I'll deal with Bill Cunningham in Tulsa and, you know, people that I know, but there are lots of other good engine shops out there. So it's a matter of figuring out which engine shop is going to be the best. And then if you get 10 prices.
Nowadays, it's which engine shop has the shortest backlog.
Has the shortest backlog.
Like, how quickly can you do this? Oh, well, yeah. You're 9 months and you're 8 months. I'm going to choose the 8 month guy.
So if all of them come, let's just say they all come out with a $40,000 price to you. Does it really matter whether your mechanic makes $2,000 or $5,000 or $2,000 markup with a $3,000 kickback? The price is still $40,000, and you've made the decision where it comes from. But I understand what you're saying, that it feels different because the shop is getting this kickback or whatever. But
yeah. That's nobody had a concern with the shop making money. The concern was just, are they going to be more influenced to recommend a certain shop
because of
the money that they're getting from that shop? And I guess another way to think about it is, if you were paying a service to advise you on repairs for your plane as it exists, you would expect, since you're paying for that service, you would expect to get unbiased, you know, advice.
If you choose to buy the engine through the shop, there's nothing wrong with going to the mechanic and saying, how much are you making on this? I mean, that's a legitimate question. Then if the answer is more than you're comfortable with, there's also nothing wrong with saying, hey, can we split the difference? There's nothing wrong with negotiating.
Dustin, thanks for the call. We appreciate you coming on.
Thank you very much.
Okay, take care. Well, that's a wrap on another fun podcast. Did we get things right, or did we miss the target on some of these questions? I know the answer to that question. We would love to hear from our listeners. Most importantly, please keep sending us those tricky questions and try to stump us. You can email any and all questions and comments to podcasts@aopa.org.
We'll see you.
Bye.